the morning of Harriet's funeral. Perhaps he hadn't slept and had gone downstairs to console himself among his collection of postage stamps, which to him, I suppose, seemed all that he had left. His wife was gone, his house and estate as good as gone. None of us were so simple-minded as to think that the moment the funeral was over, the anonymous buyer who had made the sole humiliating offer for our estate would not be pounding at the door. We would be homeless. For the first time in its long history, Buckshaw would not be in the hands of a Deluce. It simply didn't bear thinking about. I was now at the connecting door to Harriet's boudoir. I put my hand against the green baize and pushed softly. The door swung open without a whisper. Inside, a single candle flickered at the head of the catafalque. Father was kneeling on the prie-dieu, his face buried in his hands. Dare I? Putting each foot down as if I were treading on broken glass, I began making my way across the room. As one always does in dangerous circumstances, I counted my steps. 1, 2, 3, 4. I stopped. If Father lowered his hands and opened his eyes, I would be plainly visible. The flickering light made my shadow dance faintly on the velvet hangings, black on black. 5, 6. I reached out and touched the pole. Squatted. My knees gave off an alarming crack. Father's fingers dropped and his eyes shot open. He was looking to the right of where I was now crouching. He cocked an ear, turned his head towards the door, then evidently decided that the noise had come from the candle wick, or perhaps cracking wood. He gave a heart-rending sigh and lowered his face again into his cupped hands. He began whispering something, but I could not make out his words. Was it the Lord's Prayer? I didn't wait to find out. His own whispered words would be masking whatever small sounds I might make. I stuck my hand under the hem of the pall, moved it ever so slowly from side to side, feeling with my fingers for the coal scuttle. A slight click from my nails told me that I had found it. I made my fingers walk like spider legs up the side of the scuttle, over the lip, and down into its depths. I stifled a sigh of relief as my fingers touched the oilcloth packet. It was still there. The men from the Home Office had obviously been so preoccupied with their task that they hadn't wanted, or hadn't thought, to search the room. Slowly, ever so slowly, I lifted the wallet clear of the metal coal scuttle, taking great care to not make the slightest scraping. I pulled it out from under the velvet drape, and concealing it with my body, began creeping like a slow crab towards the door. But wait! The alarm clock! I could hardly leave the thing behind in the coal scuttle. One coal scuttle was as anonymous as another, but the brass alarm clock was uniquely mine. Back I crawled, delving again in the near darkness into the scuttle's depths. If I touched the wrong thing and the alarm went off, I was done for. It was like defusing an unexploded bomb. I had to rely on my sense of touch alone. Slowly, painfully, carefully, I raised the clock from its tin tomb. The silence was so excruciating, I wanted to scream. But a few moments later, I was on my way to the door again. If Father discovered me now, I decided, I would pretend I had just come in to keep him company. He could hardly object to that. But he didn't move a muscle. When I looked back from the doorway, he was still on his knees, his back ramrod straight, his head bowed, and his face pressed into his hands. It was a picture of my father that I would never forget. I closed the door gently, passed quickly through his bedroom, and slipped into the hall. Moments later, I was back in my bedroom. The clock showed 4:18. It had taken me just 16 minutes. 16 minutes. It had felt like 16 hours. Somewhere, a WC flushed, and the ancient water pipes gurgled and clanked like chains in a distant dungeon. Buckshaw was coming awake. In precisely 10 hours, I would be arriving at St. Tancred's with my family for my mother's funeral. It seemed incredible. For as long as I could remember, I had lived in a world in which a missing mother was a somewhat exotic fact of life. But all of that was now about to change. From this day forward, I would be a girl, and presumably some day a woman, whose mother, like everyone else's who has ever been bereaved, lay in the village churchyard. Nothing romantic about that. I would be just another quite ordinary person, and there was nothing I could do about it. Chapter 20. The bedrooms at Buckshaw, as I have said before, were like vast, damp Zeppelin barns, especially those in the east wing, where the loosened, water-stained wallpaper bulged from the walls in the form of wind-filled sails. Some of the rooms possessed papered ceilings that drooped overhead in musty, sagging bags, like lowering thunderclouds, except that they were green. No one ever came here, and even I had only once or twice peeked into the mouldering bedchamber at the northeast corner of the house, which, for some long-forgotten reason, had always been known as Angel's. There was nothing angelic about it. Mushrooms would have been a far more appropriate name. I knew for a fact that parts of the room glowed in the dark due to the bioluminescence of the various fungi that were happily eating away at the rotting wooden panelling which lay beneath. The lighted candle I had brought from the laboratory guttered and spat in the draughty corridor. The rusty doorknob gave a fiendish squeak, which was closely followed by a wooden groan as the door swung slowly inwards. The pong of the place struck my nose like a blow from a boxing glove. I would have to work quickly. I reached for a Louis the Something chair, but it crumbled at the touch of my hand, as did a Victorian chaise longue, which, when I accidentally kicked it, collapsed in a shower of dust and woodworms. I knew that I had no choice but to return to my laboratory for something sturdy enough to stand on. Esmeralda shifted impatiently from foot to foot as I threw into a petri dish a handful of feed, which she fell upon with the ferocity of a famished Tyrannosaurus rex, one of her early ancestors. "Manners," I reminded her, as I seized a tall laboratory stool and left her to her breakfast. Back in the room called Angels, I placed the stool near the fireplace, directly in front of an angled and jutting section of the wall that had something to do with the chimney, which lay hidden beneath. The spot was more damp than I should have liked, but it was the only part of the upper wallpaper that was within my reach. The oilcloth wallet, though, would be more than protection enough for the short time I planned on leaving it there. I won't pretend I wasn't tempted to read Harriet's will, but I also knew instinctively that it would be wrong. An unforgivable invasion of Harriet's and father's privacy that could never, ever be explained away. And besides, there wasn't time. When I had slid it into an ancient rip in the wallpaper, it was no more than just another bulge in a room full of bulges. Safe from the Home Office, safe from the police, safe even from my own family. As I climbed down from the stool, I noticed the marks its legs had left in the dust on the floor, to say nothing of my own footprints. Even Inspector Hewitt's men, Detective Sergeants Graves and Woolmer, would have been able to tell at a glance that someone in Flavia-sized shoes had stood on a four-legged stool in that very spot, and could probably even have made a fair guess as to how far up the wall I had been able to reach. I hadn't the time to find and scatter fresh dust to cover my tracks, which left only one option. I would make even more of them. So round the room I went, stamping four-legged impressions with the stool's legs everywhere, and making sure to leave as many footprints as I could manage. When I had finished, Angels looked like a ballroom in which the dance of the chimney sweeps had been held. I was proud of myself. I had made it halfway back along the hall, stool in hand, when a voice said,
What are you doing, Flavia?
It was Andine. She was standing in a little nook where breakfast tea trays had once been prepared, and I hadn't seen her until she'd already spotted me.
How long have you been there? I demanded. Does your mother know you're prowling round in the middle of the night?
It isn't the middle of the night, she corrected me. It's morning, and Ibu has already been up for hours. Besides, that's two questions, and Ibu always says, riddle me no more than once, unless you wish to be the dunce.
I could cheerfully have strangled Ibu and her daughter with the nearest pair of nutcrackers, but I controlled myself.
Ibu says today is your mother's funeral and that we mustn't mention it because it might cause you deep distress.
Ibu's very considerate, I smiled, and you may tell her I said so. I had hopeful visions of Andine parroting my words to Lena and receiving a sound thrashing for her troubles.
What are you doing with the stool?
Andine asked.
Watering plants, I replied, almost without thinking about it.
I had become a deaf liar when required, and sometimes not.
Ha!
Andine said, planting her hands on her hips, but she left it at that. Run along now, I told her, surprised at the great pleasure I took in doing so. I've got work to do. Which was no more than the truth. I had gone to the library to ferret out the meaning of the stranger's message, only to be distracted by Daffy's news about the unexpected arrival of Adam Sowerby. He and Father are old friends, Daffy had reminded me. It was true. But why was Adam suddenly here? And why now? Had he come as a friend of the family to pay his respects to Harriet? Or was he here in his role of inquiry agent? These were things I needed to know. But first, a return to the library. As I had hoped it might be, the library was now in darkness. Daffy must have gone to bed soon after I left her, because Paradise Lost was still lying open, face down, in the same position I had last seen it, which was a sure indication of my sister's state of mind. If I had left a book lying open on its face like that, she'd have flung it into my face, along with a fiery lecture on what she always referred to as respect for the printed word. I knew well enough what a gamekeeper was, since there had once been one at Buckshaw. Although that was long before my time, of course. Much more recently, Daffy had read to us selected passages from Lady Chatterley's Lover, which was interesting if you were keen on country houses, but far too full of gush and mush if you were not. I switched on a small table lamp and went directly to the Oxford English Dictionary. The Holy of Holies, as Daffy called it. 12 volumes plus supplement. The ends were in the 7th volume. I lifted it down, opened it in my lap, and ran my finger down the page. Nictation? Niddering? Niddycock? Aha! So that was where Daffy had dredged up the word.
Flavia, you dim-witted niddycock, she was fond of saying.
Daffy is the only person I know who mines the Oxford English Dictionary for insults in the same way others dig for diamonds. Ah, here it was. Nide, bracket, nide, close bracket, substantive, adaptation of French, nid, or Latin, nidus. The older French, ni, is represented by ni, confer, nid. A brood or nest of pheasants. My blood was instantly ice water. Pheasants. A nest of pheasants. Pheasant sandwiches, Harriet's words on the cine film.
And have you also acquired a taste for pheasant sandwiches, young lady?
Mr. Churchill's words at Buckshaw Holt.
But what did they mean?
My brain was crawling with words, with images, and with half-formed ideas. I knew suddenly that I needed to get away from this house of perpetual gloom, get away to somewhere I could think new thoughts, my own thoughts, rather than the worn-out thoughts of others. I would pack a breakfast lunch.
Where would I go?
I didn't know. The Dovecote at Culverhouse Farm, perhaps? The dusty tower, silent save for the cooing of the doves, was a tempting hideout. Even a couple of hours away would give me time to think, without having to worry about barges. I'd be back in plenty of time to get dressed for the funeral. Chapter 21. Mrs. Mullet jerked awake as I opened the kitchen door. I could tell by her eyes that she had been crying.
Mrs. M, what are you doing here?
Her head was still half raised from where it had been cradled in her arms on the kitchen table. She looked as if she didn't know where she was.
No, don't get up, I told her. I'll put the kettle on and make you a nice cup of tea.
Less than 5 seconds in the room, and I was already taking charge of a woman in distress.
How very, very odd.
I patted her shoulder like mad, and surprisingly, she let me. You've been here all night, haven't you? Mrs. M nodded and pressed her lips tightly together until they were white.
It's too much for you, I told her.
You've been working too hard. Daffy told me Adam Sowerby arrived last night. I'll knock him up and have him run you home.
He's gone already, love.
As a go.
Adam gone already? It didn't make sense.
Why, he'd only just arrived. I dawdled over the sink, taking my time with the kettle, waiting for the water to run cold to allow Mrs. Mullet time to wipe her eyes and poke in the ends of her hair.
You've been overdoing it, Mrs. M, I said. You must be exhausted. Why don't you go up to my room and have a nap?
No one will disturb you there.
Working too odd? Her voice was suddenly battleship steel. That's where you're wrong, Miss Flavia. I haven't been working hard enough. That's the trouble.
I put the kettle on the stove and waited for her to subside, but she didn't.
There's work to be done, and it's my place to do it.
But
don't butt me, miss. Tisn't every day Miss Harriet comes home, and tisn't every day I gets to welcome her. No one shall take that away from me. Not even you, Miss Flavia.
I went to her and put my arms around her from behind, resting my cheek on top of her head. I didn't say a word, because I didn't need to. Outside, seen from the kitchen garden, one of the larger planets, Jupiter, I think, was well up above the pink ribbon of the eastern horizon. It was the dark of the moon, and overhead the stars sparkled in the inky blue-black vault of the heavens. I was wiping the dew from Gladys's cold seat when something rustled near the greenhouse.
Dogger,
I called quietly. There was no reply.
Adam?
All right, I said. I know you're there. Come out before I call the police.
Someone stepped out of the shadows.
It was Tristram Tallis.
Sorry, he said. I didn't mean to frighten you. I was trying not to wake the household.
You didn't frighten me, I told him. I thought you were a prowler. You're lucky I didn't shoot you.
This was a bit of a stretch, even for me, and I think he knew it. Although Buckshaw did have a firearms museum, or muniment room, as Father called it, most of the weapons in its glass cases had likely not been fired since the Roundheads and the Cavaliers had squeezed their triggers in the days of Jolly Ollie Cromwell.
Good job you didn't, Tallis said. I should have been hurt if you'd potted me.
Was the man twitting me?
I decided to let it pass and find out what he was up to. You're up early. I tried to put a pinch of accusation in my voice.
I couldn't sleep. I thought I'd come down and check on Typhon. Sorry, Blythe spirit, I mean. Oil and so forth.
It seemed an unlikely excuse for a moment until I remembered that I felt the same way about Gladys.
Since it might be our last day together, I thought I'd get an early start.
Our last day together? Was he referring to me, or to Blythe's spirit?
Yes, that's right, he said, seeing the look of puzzlement on my face. I'm selling up, cashing in my chips. As the old song says, I'm off to Tipperary in the morning. I've been offered a post shuffling papers in South America.
That's not exactly Tipperary,
I said. I didn't know where Tipperary was, actually, except that it sounded as if it might be somewhere in Ireland.
No, not exactly, he grinned. I hadn't thought of that. Do you think I should wire them and tell them I've changed my mind?
Now I knew he was teasing me.
No, I said, you should go. But leave Blythe Spirit here at Buckshaw, so that when I'm old enough, I can learn to fly her.
I would if I could, but the old girl, see, you've got me calling her an old girl, needs hangering, plus the gentle hand of a good mechanic.
Dogger could look after her, I said.
Dogger, after all, could do anything.
He shook his head sadly.
I'm afraid I've sold her, he said.
I felt my heart sink within me. Blythe Spirit sold? I don't know why, but it didn't seem right. She had, after all, been sold before.
Look here, Tristram Tallis said. How would it be if I took you for a flip?
At first, I didn't understand him, didn't know what he was suggesting.
A flip?
A flight.
Could this be true?
Could it actually be happening to me? I had once asked Father what Buckshaw looked like from the air.
Ask your Aunt Felicity, he'd said. She's flown.
I never had, of course. Now the opportunity was staring me straight in the face. That's very kind of you, Mr. Tallis, but I couldn't possibly accept without permission. I knew already what Father's reply would be, even if I was willing to intrude upon him, which I wasn't. What a disappointment, though, having to refuse my only chance to take to the air in Harriet's Blythe Spirit. My spirits were already sinking when a second figure stepped from the shadows. It was Dogger. He handed me a red woolly jumper I had mislaid a week ago in the greenhouse.
"Put this on, Miss Flavia," he said, without so much as a smile. "The air can be remarkably cold in the mornings."
Then I, with a silly grin splitting my face from side to side in the damp dawn, was sprinting across the visto towards Blythe Spirit. Tristram Tallis strapped me into the front seat and left me sitting there alone as he made a tour of inspection round the aircraft, touching here, wiggling there, peering at one thing and another. I took the opportunity to have a quick look round the cockpit in which I was sitting. I think I had been expecting something quite wonderful in a machine which was capable of flying up among the gods, but this one seemed horribly under-equipped for such a journey. A simple stick that jutted up out of the floor, and a couple of dials and gauges on a wooden panel. And that was all. Surely this thing was too frail to fly. I was beginning to think I had made a mistake. Perhaps I should beg off, but it was too late. After a couple of half-hearted swings at the propeller, Tristram returned to the cockpit, threw a switch, and gave it another try. There was an alarming mechanical clanking from the engine, a burst of smoke, and with a roar the propeller disappeared in a blur. The wings teetered alarmingly as he clambered aboard.
"All set,"
he shouted, as he fastened himself in the back seat, and I, clutching the edges of the cockpit, managed a grim nod. The roar became a tornado, and we began to move, slowly at first, but with ever-increasing speed, until we were rattling along cross-country like the Hindley Hunt in full cry. Faster and faster still we went, until I thought Blythe Spirit was about to tear herself to pieces. And then a sudden smoothness. We were flying. Rather than us rising up into the air as I had expected we would, the earth fell away beneath us like a carpet being jerked out from under one's feet by some unseen practical joker. I had no more than a fleeting impression of the roofs of Buckshaw before the ornamental lake was floating quickly past below us. The sun was an enormous red fire balloon on the horizon, as we rose up out of the shadows and into the sudden daylight. It was breathtaking. If Feely and Daffy had dashed to their windows at the noise of our takeoff, I would be no more to them now than a fly speck in the distance. Just as I always was, I couldn't help thinking. But beneath our wings, the marvellous toy world slid slowly by.
hills, fields, woods and valleys, dales, dells, ponds and groves. Far below us, miniature sheep grazed in handkerchief pastures. It made me want to write a hymn. Hadn't even Johann Sebastian Bach composed something about sheep? Away to the east, the rising sun struck a sharp glint off the river, and for a few moments, as we turned away from it, the Efon was a shimmering snake of rubies, crawling off towards a distant sea. How Harriet must have loved this, I thought, the freedom of it all, the sense of having left one's body, but not one's mind, behind. Unless you happened to be a bird, the body was of little use up here. You could not run or jump as you did on the ground, but only observe. In a strange way, being an aviator was like being a departed soul. You could look down upon the earth without actually being present, see all without being seen. It was easy enough to see why God, having called the dry land earth and the gathering together of the waters the seas, saw that it was good. I could picture the old fellow lifting up the horizon like the lid of a stewing pot and peeking in with one red eye to admire his creation, to see how it was coming along. It was good. Tristram was waving a hand, pointing downwards. Bly's spirit tilted precipitously to one side, and I found myself looking down the wing at an oddly familiar collection of buildings. Bishop's Lacey's High Street. There was the 13 Drakes, inside which all those official people from the railway station, those bullies from the Home Office, presumably billeted in every nook and cranny, even unto the broom cupboards, if Daffy was to be believed, were dreaming their dreadful dreams of power. And down there, in Cow Lane, was the Bishop's Lacey Free Library, and Tilda Mountjoy's Willow Villa, even more gaudily orange than usual in the light of the early morning. We had now flown through half of a vast clockwise circle and were turning south again. Ahead, I could see the Parlings, that curious bend in the river at the edge of our estate, and I wondered what the Hobblers, that peculiar cult who had once baptized their babies at that spot, might have made of our flying machine appearing suddenly in the sky. A little to the east, the gully ran along the river to Gouger Hill, down which Gladys and I had so often raced and fallen breathless at the bottom. And there was the jack-o'-lantern, the skull-like outcropping which loomed over the Parlings. I had promised to meet Lena there for a picnic after the funeral. Almost directly to the east, at the very bottom of Pooka's Lane, was Rook's End, and I smiled at the thought of Dr. Kissing. The old gentleman would already be up and puffing at his first cigarette of the day. Perhaps we could give him a bit of a show. Buzz the aerodrome, as the pilots at Leithcote would have said. It would be good to let Father's old headmaster know that someone was thinking of him. I grinned at the thought of his speculating for hours about whom it might have been. Flavia Deluce was the last person on earth he'd ever think of. I waved frantically with both hands to get Tristram's attention and pointed down at Rook's End. He must have done this sort of thing before, because the stick in front of me lunged suddenly forward and to one side, and we were hurtling down towards the earth at a terrific speed, the wings whistling and the wind howling in the wires like banshees. "Yaroo!" I wanted to shout, but I kept it to myself. I didn't want Tristram to think I was immature. Just when it seemed we must become a permanent blot on the landscape, we pulled up out of the dive, and I watched as our winged shadow raced across the stony face of the jack-o'-lantern. We had cheated death. Now we were floating lazily along, just above the treetops of the park at Rook's End. As the house came into view, I noticed several motor cars parked in the forecourt. It would have been difficult to miss them. One was an apple-green Rolls-Royce, with the rear part of its roof peeled away to form a makeshift greenhouse. There couldn't possibly be another like it in the entire world. It was Nancy, Adam Sowerby's old roller. And parked beside it was an angular mint-green Land Rover.
Lena Deleuze. What the dickens was she doing here? Why would she and Adam be meeting at Rook's End at such an ungodly hour of the morning? What could the two of them possibly want with Dr. Kissing? For surely it was him they had come to see. Who else could possibly bring them to this remote and frankly uninviting home for decayed gentlefolk? My thoughts were interrupted by a sudden silence. Tristram had throttled back Blyspirit's engine, and we had entered into a gentle glide. Buckshaw was dead ahead. "We're going to crash!" I was sure of it as the ground rushed up to meet us. But we slipped through the quiet air above the Mulford gates, skimmed the treetops of the Avenue of Chestnuts, and alighted on the visto as gently as a mayfly on a rose petal.
"Well?" Tristram demanded.
We had come to rest, and he was already climbing out of the back cockpit.
"What did you think?"
"Most instructive," I said.
Chapter 22.
"Dogger," I asked, "what possible reason could Adam Sowerby and Lena Deleuze have for driving to Rook's End before sunrise?"
"I'm sure I can't say, Miss Flavia."
"Can't say or won't say?"
My conversations with Dogger were often like that, a gentle game between two chess masters.
"Can't say.
I don't know."
"What do you know?"
Dogger gave the ghost of a smile, and I knew that he was enjoying this as much as I was.
"I know that each left in his or her own vehicle at approximately 5:12 this morning."
"Anything else?"
"And that the elder Miss Deleuze, your Aunt Felicity, accompanied them."
"What?"
It was unheard of that Aunt Felicity, who loved nothing better than to barricade herself in her bedroom, armed with no more than toaster, tea, and the latest thriller, should go gallivanting round the countryside in the dark of the moon. Simply unheard of.
Where were they going?
"At a guess, Rook's End," Dogger said. "An assumption confirmed, perhaps, at least in part, by your own aerial reconnaissance."
His placid, utterly impassive face told me there was more.
"And?" I demanded. "What else?"
"Colonel Deleuze accompanied them."
My whole world tilted, as if I was still in the air, making a steep turn in blithe spirit. If it was unheard of for Aunt Felicity to venture out beyond the bounds of Buckshaw, the fact that Father would... No, I simply refused to believe it.
"Are you sure?" I asked.
Perhaps Dogger was having a gentle joke, although it seemed unlikely.
"Quite sure," he said.
"Did he say where he was going?"
"He did not, and I did not inquire."
Was there a message in Dogger's words? Was he warning me to mind my own business? Dogger's loyalty, I sometimes had to remind myself, was first of all to Father, and I must never, for any reason, impose upon that devotion.
"Thank you, Dogger," I said. "You've been very helpful."
"Not at all, Miss Flavia," he said, with that look on his face. "I am always pleased to be of service."
Alone in my laboratory, I tried desperately to keep my mind occupied in the hours remaining before the funeral, by resuming an experiment I had been considering when news had come of Harriet's discovery in the Himalayas. It is a fact of nature that, given sufficient quantities, poison can be obtained from even the most harmless organic substances. Tapioca and rhubarb, for instance, contain exquisite death if the wrong parts of the plant are used in their preparation, and even our dear old friend water, H2O, is capable of poisoning if too much of the stuff is drunk in too short a span of time. I made a couple of notes, but my heart just wasn't in it. I threw down my pencil. Although I loathed the very idea, it was likely time to begin dressing for the day. Mrs. Mullet had fetched out and cleaned one of the mothballed school uniforms that Harriet, when she was my age, had been made to wear at Miss Bodicote's Female Academy
in Toronto, Canada. A black-belted horror worn with long black stockings and a white blouse that made me look like one of those grotesque but amusing creatures from Ronald Searle's St. Trinian's cartoons. Like Father and Dogger, Mr. Searle had been a prisoner of the Japanese in Singapore, and his work was much admired by some of us at Buckshaw. I scrubbed my face and teeth, cleaned the remnants of my nails, sighed deeply, and turned to the task I most truly despised, the braiding of my hair into pigtails. I had tried everything I could think of to make it an adventure. I had pretended that I was a pirate, lashed to the main mast in a howling hurricane, splicing the only rope that could secure the last remaining sail. Right over left, and up, and under, left over right. Ha ha, me hearties, simple as sin, break out the grog. But it was no use. Transforming a haystack of mousy brown hair into a length of romantic rigging was too much to hope for. The worst thing about dressing one's own hair was the fact that it needed to be done backwards. It was like playing a game of In a Glass Darkly in Girl Guides, in which one must try to write one's full name with pencil on a scrap of paper while looking in a mirror. ECULED ANIBAS AIVALF. A game during which I always wished I had been born plain old Ava Oxo, or at least someone with a more symmetrical name. The losers and the clumsy players were always hooted heartily, and it was at those times I most often found my thoughts turning to the subject of poisons. I secured the ends of the pigtails with a couple of blue ribbons tied into neat bows. Yellow was too cheerful for the occasion, red too gaudy, and orange out of the question. I stared at myself in the looking glass. Who was this girl with her mother's face? It was as if I were wearing a Harriet mask for carnival and had not noticed it until now. And, to tell the truth, it frightened me. Breakfast at Buckshaw was always a glum affair, and this morning was no exception. Tristram and Adam were seated at the foot of the table, as if to keep a respectful distance from the grieving family. Father, all in black, sat at the head, his palms flat on the table. He had touched not a crumb of his breakfast, and it seemed unlikely that he would do so. Beside him, Feely was a pale ghost, nibbling absently at a piece of dry toast. She needed to keep her strength up if she was to be at the organ for Harriet's funeral. Everyone from family to the vicar and his wife had tried to dissuade her, but all in vain. Feely was as steely cold in her stubborn resolve as only a wispy-looking musician can be. Daffy, cocooned in some kind of comic musty Victorian mourning outfit, was helping herself to another kipper. Her acid glance defied me to say anything. When she was like this, even Father knew better than to risk a single word. Aunt Felicity sat at the middle of the table, well apart from both groups, humming mindlessly to herself like a hive of distant bees. Adam gave me the tiniest of nods before resuming his quiet conversation with Tristram, who did not give me so much as a glance. It was as if our early morning flight had been merely a dream. And perhaps it had. Perhaps it had never happened. A time traveller materialising at our breakfast table from some far future would have supposed that Mrs. Mallet was the only one of us who was flesh and blood with the deceased. Mrs. M., to be perfectly honest, looked a wreck. Her face was flushed, her eyes brimming with unshed tears, and her hair sticking out like jackstraws. She fished a kipper and a couple of bangers from their serving dishes and placed them on my plate. Her lips were even more tightly pressed together than they had been before, as if they were now additionally secured by C-clamps. She said not a word, and I realized in that instant how deep was her despair. I reached out to touch her hand, but she was already gone.
Breakfast broke up with no more than a few hushed words exchanged between the two guests at the foot of the table. I excused myself and left the room. I would go to my laboratory and try to set down in my notes the confusion that was in my mind. I was no more than halfway across the foyer when the doorbell rang. Dogger appeared from nowhere, as he often does so uncannily, and swung the heavy door back on its hinges. Two delivery men in overalls, their arms filled with flowers, stood waiting. Behind them, on the gravel sweep, their van, open at the back, overflowed with bouquets, wreaths, and carpeted arrangements of carnations, cornflowers, arum lilies, and forget-me-nots, all nestled in beds of Queen Anne's lace. There were gladioli, peonies, and roses, marigolds, chrysanthemums, and irises. It was as if the gardens of heaven had been raided and the plunder delivered to our door with more than enough flowers to overflow the foyer. In spite of the early hour, a fresh queue of mourners had already formed, snaking round the van and making a straggling half-circle in the forecourt. As the men spat on their hands and began the long job of moving the flowers into the house, Dogger produced a small notebook from his vest pocket and began carefully cataloguing the names of the senders, which he read from the pasteboard cards attached to each arrangement. It was as if all the world had known Harriet, and all the world in mourning had sent their floral tributes.
"Sorry about your mother," a voice said at my ear. "Rotten bad luck. I should have hoped it would turn out better than this."
I span round, knowing already that it was Adam Sowerby, or, to give him the whole McGillicuddy, as it was so prominently printed on his card, which I still had tucked away in the pages of a recent notebook. Adam Tradescant Sowerby, M.A.F.R. Hort S., etc., Flora Archaeologist, Seeds of Antiquity, Cuttings, Inquiries, Tower Bridge, London, E1, T.N. Royal 1066. He was, of course, something of a fraud. While working in the guise of an archaeological botanist, retrieving and coaxing back into germination the seeds of plants and flowers thought to be long extinct, the man was actually an inquiry agent, or, to put it more plainly, a private detective. When he learned of my recent successes, he had tried to recruit me as his partner in criminal investigation. But I had quickly discovered that the man took more than he gave. Worse than that, he had point-blank refused to tell me whom he was working for. Since Adam was an old friend of father's, there wasn't much that I could do to keep him off my pitch. But there was no law that said I had to cooperate.
"It must have been a very great shock," he said,
still talking, even though I hadn't been listening. I nodded and headed for the staircase.
"As must have been that poor bloke at the station."
I stopped in my tracks. How did Adam know about that? Had he been there? I thought he had only arrived last night. Had he already been in consultation with the police? I could hardly believe that Inspector Hewitt would confide in a private inquiry agent, and a private inquiry agent from London at that. Of course, by now, the circumstances of the stranger's death must be the talk of the village. Perhaps that was why some of the mourners had looked at me so oddly. Adam might well have stopped and been given the goods at Bert Archer's petrol station, or at the 13 Drakes. Or might he have heard the grisly details from someone here at Buckshaw? If that was the case, the burning question was, from whom? Who else in the house had seen what happened on the railway platform? If Inspector Hewitt, out of sympathy for the family, had delayed his questioning of the household's inhabitants, who else had witnessed the murder? Who else was keeping silent? "All right," I said, turning round reluctantly. "Tell me what you know." There are people who are able to deflect direct questions as easily as a duck sheds water, and Adam, I knew, was one of them.
"Terence Alphiston Tardaman, bachelor, of 3A, Campden Gardens, Notting Hill Gate, London, W8, aged 37,
Adam's frankness surprised me. How do you know that?
No magic involved, he said. I'd been following him for 5 days. This time.
What do you mean, this time? Have you followed him before?
Adam nodded. Off again, on again, gone again, Finnegan. It's been going on for years.
I hadn't the faintest idea what he was referring to, but I pretended I did. Who was he? I asked, other than his name.
That's what I've been trying to discover, Adam said. As Mr. Churchill once so aptly put it, Tardaman was a riddle inside a mystery, wrapped in an enigma. And now that he's dead, more so than ever.
Mr. Churchill was at the station, I found myself saying. He spoke to me. Oh, fluff. I have blurted it out without thinking.
Winnie quite often likes to insert himself at the heart of the action, Adam told me, rather like Alfred Hitchcock's cameo appearances in his own films, but somewhat more risky. What did he have to say? He added casually.
Just that he was sorry, I said. I was certainly not going to tell him that Mr. Churchill had asked,
And have you also acquired a taste for pheasant sandwiches, young lady?
With Inspector Hewitt and his men of the Hindley Constabulary and Adam Tradescant Sowerby, inquiries, on the case, I knew instinctively to keep certain information to myself. That I had let slip the fact that Mr. Churchill had spoken to me was troubling. I would need to be far more discreet in future. I was trying to think of a way to remove myself from this dangerous conversation when someone laid a large hand on my shoulder. It was the vicar, Denwin Richardson, and behind him stood his wife, Cynthia.
"Dearest Flavia," he said, "we've been looking for you everywhere. I've spoken to your father, of course, but I told him we were sorry not to have travelled with you to Buckshaw from the station yesterday. But what with poor Mrs. Dainty being taken so suddenly, and everything being consequently at sixes and sevens, to say nothing of the fact that our telephone at the rectory chose that moment to, well, how very, very sorry we are that things have come to such a—" Cynthia brushed past him and wrapped me in such a tight and quaking hug that I thought my bones would surely shatter. We had had our battles, Cynthia and I, and it was only recently that I had learned of the tragic death, 7 years ago Christmas, of their daughter, Hannah. Hannah had been 4 years old, my exact age at the time, when she fell beneath the wheels of a train at Doddingsley Station. She had been laid to rest in a so far unmarked grave in the churchyard of St. Tancred's, and the villagers had begun a conspiracy of silence to shield the Richardsons from grief and guilt. The little girl had darted away from her father on that tragic long-ago Christmas, and he had blamed himself. The trembling of Cynthia's embrace became a chill as I realized what a harsh reminder the death of Terence Tardaman must be to them. That whole ghastly nightmare on the railway platform brought back to life and shoved in their faces, as it were. I felt my tears coming, and before I could stop them, they were dribbling down Cynthia's neck. Rather than pulling away, though, she was now hugging me all the harder. How sorry I suddenly felt for this poor little woman. This poor, unfortunate little creature upon whom I had wasted so much hatred over the years. What kind of life did she have when you stop to think about it? All of her days and nights were given over to visiting the sick, arranging flowers for the church, chairing meetings of this committee and that, booking the parish hall, cooking 3 meals a day for her husband, typing up and printing handbills and posters on a hectograph, or churning out church bulletins on a banda machine. To say nothing of managing her husband's timetable, mending his clothes, starching his surplices, running the church library, and listening to the troubles of everyone in Bishop's Lacey. Being married to a man who dressed himself in vestments was no holiday camp. She didn't seem to want to let me go. The hug went on until I thought to say,
"Oh, I'm sorry. I must be hurting you."
At that point, we both gave a little laugh,
and released our life and death grip on each other. Adam, meanwhile, had wandered away and was critically inspecting the funeral flowers. I was dying to ask him what he thought, but I didn't dare. Dogger had now admitted those from the head of the queue, and the long trudge up the stairs to Harriet's boudoir had resumed. It would go on until just after noon, when preparations for departure would begin. I could only hope and pray that those officious creatures from the Home Office had thought to stop the dripping. I took my leave of the Richardsons and climbed the stairs to the east wing. In the top corridor, I knew instantly that I was not alone. There is a vibration in the air that is not a sound and not a smell, but more a feeling in the atmosphere that signals, without fail, the presence of another. I flung open the door of my bedroom and marched inside. But no one was there. Then the laboratory. Except for Esmeralda, it too was empty. Down the hall I crept on tiptoe, taking great care to avoid the squeaky floorboard in front of the nook. I put my hand on the knob of Angel's and threw open the door. Undine was standing on the laboratory stool, the oilcloth wallet in her hand. She had fished it out of its hiding place behind the baggy wallpaper.
"You lied to me," she said, wide-eyed with indignation. "You told me you were watering plants."
I have to give the girl credit. Not only had she found the hidden wallet, but she had manufactured a remarkably good response when I caught her red-handed. It was exactly the kind of thing I might have thought of myself. Some day I might even tell her that, but not now. I marched smartly across the room and snatched the packet from her hands.
"You little beast," I said. "Is this how you repay kindness?" "You crept up on me," Undine pouted. "Ibu said you were devious."
"Ibu did she? Did she say anything else?"
"Yes. She told me to keep an eye on you."
"Keep an eye on me?" That was the last straw. "Tell me something, Undine," I said. "Do you know how to say buzz off in Malay?"
"Barambus."
"Excellent. Barambus."
"Are you dismissing me?"
she asked. "You're a very perceptive child," I said, shoving her out the door. "Now, tally-ho, and don't come back."
"Brute,"
Undine said, getting in the last word, as I somehow knew she would.
"Ibu was right."
I gave her the response she deserved. I crossed my eyes horribly and stuck out my tongue at her.
"Ain't you beautiful?"
she giggled, and then she was gone. Beautiful? It was the first time anyone had called me that, even as an insult. I examined my image in one of the dusty, peeling mirrors that hung in the dim hall. "If I were a painting," I thought, "it would be called Girl in Black, and would probably be by one of those artists, such as the American Whistler." I was little more than a white face, staring out at myself from a gloomy background. The only spot of colour, my eyes. It made me feel so old, so sad, so much a part of the house, so much a Deleuze. The face was, of course, Harriet's face. Father had told me recently that I wasn't just like Harriet, but that I was Harriet. I didn't even have a face to call my own. It was in that moment, looking at myself, staring back at myself, that something, somewhere deep inside, went click, as if the universe and I with it had, like a grandfather clock, moved on to the next cog of a clunking wooden gear. I can't explain it any more clearly